This week on Pirate Party Radio, YouTube accuses Viacom of secretly uploading copyrighted material. Protests in the UK over digital economy bill being rushed through Parliament, and the full ACTA text is finally leaked online. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 21 for Thursday, March 25th, 2010.
It's also important to understand, because, you know, I'm a parent, I would worry about the illegal downloading that my children might do through my broadband connection at home, and whether I'll then get that cut off. There's a whole process.
Well, if you make it illegal, of course. Yeah. I mean, the point is it right to turn 7 million people in, potentially 7 million people, those are figures you use, into lawbreakers?
Well, what's important to say is within the bill, there's a whole process that you get to before you get your connection turned off. A whole series of warnings so that this doesn't come as a sudden shock that, you know, your son or daughter in their bedroom has broken the law and suddenly this happens to you. You would get plenty of warning, and it's a last resort.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cause. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. Now, off the top of the show, we had a clip from Jim Knight speaking about the digital economy bill and trying to convince everyone how wonderful it is, relating it to the children, of course. That's the magic secret password to unlock any type of bill or law that you want enacted in any country, just related to either pedophilia or the children. You know, either or is fine. I've got some incoming messages. It says, hey, this is from Desette. Dealing with passwords, I've always had a problem remembering my long, complicated passwords. And this is related to last week when I was talking about passwords and how to keep them safe and software and stuff to remember them by. But I have a few quick tidbits of advice for anyone with the problem of remembering and creating a strong password. Number one, using upper and lower case. Two, using numbers. Three, using special symbols like the exclamation mark, at, the pound, dollar sign, and percent sign. Using number pad symbols if allowed. The alt characters, typing alt 0176, which gives the degrees sign. Use a different password for each site and change it monthly. Use a password that has a memory trick for that site, and he gives some examples below. Use a password that has a memory trick for that month and see examples, and avoid words, names, and passwords. Words, names, and birthdays, not passwords, because you have to have a password. So let's say your password is normally rabbit87, and you're logging into a forum like Rant Media. So first we'll use the month, site, and base password and general rules. So he puts a month in the beginning, 0318, so it'll be March 18th, and then R-A-N-T, but for the capital R, then an at symbol for the A, and then bunny, capital B for bunny, and then M, at R, and then the degrees sign. So he throws all of those in there. And now we have this formula. Numbers that are something easy to remember with the site, day of sign up, or patter on the keyboard. Site nickname plus special word plus current month plus special character. So he's saying throw as much stuff into it as possible and it will become a more secure password. And in combination with the software that you can find out there that keeps your password safe, that of course you'll have to know a master password, but you'll have just one that one password to remember. And if you go to a site often enough, you'll remember your password no matter how convoluted it is. You'll have muscle memory typing it on the keyboard, etc. And the main part of this is if it's too long to make a formula, remember that instead, and then the rest comes easy, or at least easier. Hope that helps. Regards to Set. Well, thank you very much to Set for passing on that helpful information. Next one's from Jay. You may be interested in including the following quote by Fred Rogers in defense of personal recording devices from 1979. Now, this is when VCRs and Beta machines were first coming out. I mention this because it came to my attention that his birthday is on Saturday, and thought this would be appropriate because, hey, who didn't love Mr. Rogers? And the quote is, "Some public stations, as well as commercial stations, program the neighborhood at hours which some children cannot use it. I think that it's a real service to families to be able to record such programs and show them at appropriate times. I've always felt that with the advent of all this new technology that allows people to tape the neighborhood off air, I'm speaking for the neighborhood because that's what I produce. Then they have become much more active in the programming of a family's television life. Very frankly, I'm opposed to people being programmed by others. My whole approach in broadcasting has always been, you're an important person just the way you are. You can make healthy decisions. Maybe I'm going on too long, but I just feel that anything that allows a person to become more active in the control of his or her life in a healthy way is important." And that's from Jay about Fred Rogers, or Mr. Rogers. Talking about the importance of time shifting and be able to, in essence, being able to use the media where you want, when you want, and on what device that you want, rather than being at the beck and call of the people who are putting out the media and trying to control where you see it and when, because he's talking about kids that aren't able to watch his show. And with the advent of the VCR and the Beta machine, they were able to tape the show at an earlier time than watch it whenever they wanted. And the large market was, the corporate market was trying to ban the VCR and ban the Beta machine, which is almost unthinkable at this time, because they're such a huge part of the development of home video, which took off huge in the 80s, and of course, which led to DVDs, etc. So if anybody has a copy of that speech, I would love to get a copy of that speech, because that is an amazing speech from Fred Rogers. I doubt anybody has a copy of it because it was back in 1979, and maybe it wasn't even broadcast. Maybe it was just that's a dictation of it. So if you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. On to the news, and there's some crazy news this week. A lot of interesting news. Copyright news from the U.S. YouTube, Viacom secretly posted its videos, even as they sued us for not taking down Viacom videos. This was first sent in by DC. I got a flood of email from everyone about this story because it was such a huge story. This particular one's off boingboing.net, and I've also linked to the original blog post by YouTube/Google explaining what is going on. In a scorching post on the company's blog, YouTube chief counsel Zahava Levine accuses Viacom of going to great lengths to secretly upload videos to YouTube in order to take advantage of its promotional value, even as they were suing YouTube, arguing that YouTube should be able to tell the difference between Viacom videos that were uploaded by actual infringers as opposed to Viacom employees and agents being paid to pretend to be infringers. And so the blog post goes, "For years, Viacom continuously and secretly uploaded its content to YouTube, even while publicly complaining about its presence there. It hired no fewer than 18 different marketing agencies to upload its content to the site. It deliberately roughed up the videos to make them look like they were stolen or leaked. It opened YouTube accounts using phony email addresses. It even sent employees to Kinko's to upload clips from computers that couldn't be traced to Viacom. And in an effort to promote its own shows, as a matter of company policy, Viacom routinely left up clips from shows that had been uploaded to YouTube by ordinary users. Executives as high up as the president of Comedy Central and the head of MTV Networks felt very strongly that clips from shows like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report should remain on YouTube. Viacom's efforts to disguise its promotional use of YouTube worked so well that even its own employees could not keep track of everything it was posting or leaving up on the site. As a result, on countless occasions, Viacom demanded the removal of clips that it had uploaded to YouTube, only to return later to sheepishly ask for their reinstatement. In fact, some of the very clips that Viacom is suing us over were actually uploaded by Viacom itself. Given Viacom's own actions, there's no way YouTube could ever have known which Viacom content was and was not authorized to be on the site. But Viacom thinks that YouTube should somehow have figured it out. The legal rule that Viacom seeks would require YouTube and every web platform to investigate and police all content users upload and would subject those websites to crushing liability if they got it wrong. So, in essence, what they're talking about is that everything in the world is copyrighted. As soon as you make it, as soon as you write it down, as soon as you record it, it's copyrighted by you. Of course, if you just recorded it from somebody else, this is as the laws stand today. If you just, you know, copied it off the television, recorded it, and uploaded to YouTube, it's currently copyrighted by the person who originally created it, not you by, you know, transmitting it into a different form. So YouTube is talking about it's impossible to tell the difference between somebody anonymously uploading copyrighted content made by somebody else and to distinguish it from the copyrighted material that the original people are uploading. And really, in the end, there is no difference between the two copyrighted pieces of material because it's all copyrighted no matter who uploaded it or where it came from. The original content is the copyrighted content. So YouTube is arguing that it's impossible to be able to run a site like they do, or run any site, in fact, where there is copyright infringement possible for alleged to be accused of hosting copyrighted material because everything's copyrighted. If I post my what I type for the show format or something that I've written on a website, it's copyrighted by me. Now, if somebody else takes that text and uploads it somewhere else, how is that content provider going to know the difference if I uploaded that or if the other person took my words and uploaded to that site? They can't. It's impossible. It's an immeasurable task to undertake for an ISP to do that, to be able to distinguish that. And really, the web, the internet as we know it, would come to a crawl, where it's a walled garden where everything had to be stamped and approved and checked out before it went up. Nothing would ever be posted. It would be an impossible thing to police. And it's not a place where I want to go and where I want to surf. It's just a place that would shut down and become unusable. Global copyright news. ACTA stakeholder meeting on March 22nd, a couple days ago. And this is posted on michaelgeist.ca blog. Amazing blog. Something you need to bookmark. michaelgeist.ca. If you like this show, you'll love his blog. I get so much information from his blog and stuff that he links to. And I've also posted the video. It's, I think, almost 2 hours long, or at least an hour and a half. And I watched it all, I think, yesterday or the day before. Very interesting stuff. The European Commission, well, I'll read the story. The European Commission hosted a fascinating consultation on ACTA today. Luc de Vigne, the lead European negotiator, opened with a brief presentation and proceeded to field questions for over an hour. The full consultation video is available online. The discussion touched on many issues, including de Vigne's arguing that the WTO consistently blocked any attempt to address IP enforcement issues and stating that the treaty is limited to enforcement and not new substantive provisions. This assumes that the anti-circumvention rules are a matter of enforcement, not substance. The two big issues of the day were the three strikes and the European Parliament ACTA resolution. On the three strikes, Devine repeatedly stated that the EU was bounded by EU law and that was not supporting any inclusion of three strikes in ACTA. In fact, Devine went further in claiming that no one had even proposed the possibility of three strikes. This, despite the fact that a memo produced by his own department stated, EU understands that footnote 6 provides for an example of a reasonable policy to address the unauthorized storage or transmission of protected materials. However, the issue of termination of subscriptions and accounts has been subject to much debate in the several member states. Furthermore, the issue on whether a subscription or account may be terminated without prior court decision is still subject to negotiations between European Parliament and the Council of Telecoms Minister regarding the telecoms package. This refers to a footnote in the ACTA text proposed by the US, which states an example of such a policy is providing for the termination of appropriate circumstances of subscriptions and or accounts on the service provider system or network of repeat infringers. In the sentence, the US has proposed using the word and, while the Australians prefer or. I would argue that Mr. Devine would be more credible if he'd not base unequivocal statements on the fact that the text appears in a footnote and not within the article itself. The other contentious issues was the effect of the European Parliament resolution on ACTA. The resolution states that the Parliament calls on the Commission to continue the negotiations on ACTA and limit them to the existing European IPR enforcement system against counterfeiting. Devine was repeatedly asked whether the European Commission would respect this part of the resolution. The response was to point to another part of the resolution stating the Parliament urges the Commission to ensure the enforcement of the ACTA provisions, especially those on copyright enforcement procedures in the digital environment, are fully in line with the Acquis Communautaire. To suggest that there was a conflict within the resolution, or at least an opening to continue discussions beyond counterfeiting matters, the discussion which included the actual members of the European Parliament suggests there is a future court fight over respect for the resolution is a possibility. So it's very interesting during that Q&A that he was completely denying that there was any talks, even suggestions, even anybody bringing it up that there was a three strikes rule. But yet he has memos stating that there is something akin to a three strikes rule, not saying three, but a increased penalty system in which people could be kicked off the internet. So he's speaking out two sides of his mouth. But of course, if you watch the video, he repeatedly states that he will not comment on any leaks. Of course, there is no official documentation from ACTA from anyone. So really, he could say anything he wants because nobody has seen the official statements. And to this day, there is no official ACTA agreement that has been seen by anyone. Now, note the word official, I'm saying, not the leaks, because there was a leak of the full ACTA agreement that I'll get to in a later story. Global open government. Web inventor calls for government data transparency, cited by ad nauseum. Countries should be judged on their willingness to open up public data to their citizens, the inventor of the World Wide Web has told the BBC. He said openness of data and neutrality of the network should be considered as important as free speech. Sir Tim Berners-Lee is an advisor to the UK project data.gov.uk that offers reams of previously hidden public sector data for anyone to use. Open data could now be considered a basic right of citizens, he added. I think obviously that there are four more fundamental ones, but within a democratic society, if the democracy is going to work, you have to have an informed electorate, he told the BBC. He said that this was particular importance for developing countries. The openness of the government is one of the things which makes investors deciding whether to invest, he said. When you make the government open, when they can see what's happening, they're much more likely to bring their money and companies into your country. Many groups around the world are now using open public data to hold public bodies to account. In Brazil, a website that tracks the published wealth of politicians has created many political casualties. Journalist Fernando Rodriguez built the online database Políticos de Brasil, do Brasil, which contains details the campaign finances of 400,000 politicians. The site was started in 2000, but as the information becomes more complete, its power increases. He told the BBC that he believed it had contributed to the removal from the office of hundreds of politicians after the 2008 local elections. Only 6 months after the election, 343 mayors and legislators had already lost their jobs because so much data was available about them, and it became easy to identify wrongdoings during the electoral process, he said. Other countries are less forthcoming with publication of data, but allowing their citizens to access it in other ways. In India, for example, the 2005 Right to Information Act has been met with great enthusiasm. So far, around 2 million requests for the information has been made. People are monitoring the act, looking out for it, constantly questioning the government, he told the BBC. That kind of public ownership is the biggest lesson I think India can give the world. Even lack of internet access is not a barrier for some determined groups. Indian Freedom of Information Group MKSS, based in Rajasthan, monitors government payments to rural workers. The group has been a major force for pushing for greater openness in government of India. It collates the information, which may originally have been stored digitally, then goes into the villages and paints the result on walls. The wall represents a kind of web wall for anyone can come and read that information, said Nikki Day of the group. In both India and Brazil, campaigners would like to see more government data proactively published. Even when the data is unavailable, people are providing that the internet can be used to hold people to account. So this, it continues on, a good read about the positive aspects of open government and being able to, you know, hold your government to account and see really where your money is going, what the government is doing with it, and whether they're being paid off or not by big corporations and being influenced by things they really shouldn't be influenced by. They're working for the people and not for the corporations. So this is a great step, and a lot of countries can follow this kind of lead that is happening in the other countries. It continues on. Website says there's wheredoesmymoneygo.org is already leading the charge in the UK. But Mr. Loosemore said that there's still a long way to go in fully harnessing the power of public data in the UK. There's an awful lot to play out, but the dam has been breached, he said. So that's good news from the UK. Or around the world, in fact. Free speech news from Australia. Google tells Australia its net filters go away too far. Google has been a huge powerhouse as of late in the censorship push against censorship in China. Whether you question their motives, good or bad, or why they're doing it, they are fighting against censorship in one way or another, or at least bringing censorship to light. Google tells Australia its net filters go way too far. This is sent in by Mind Inversion. This can't be the way that Australia wanted it. One day after Google announced its decision to stop censoring its search results in China, the Australian government released the results of a public consultation on its own internet censorship proposal. Predictably, Google has some objections, including an oblique comment that Australia's mandatory filtering scheme could confer legitimacy upon filtering by other governments. Australia is rightly regarded as a liberal democracy that balances individual liberty with social responsibility, continues the Google filing. The governments of many other countries may justify, by reference to Australia, their use of filtering, their lack of disclosures about what is being filtered, and their political direction of agencies administering filtering. Google is unlikely to come right out and compare Australia to China, but the implication is obvious and has been made explicit by other groups. Reporters Without Borders said recently that Australia would be joining an internet censors club that includes such countries as China, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. Australia does not currently impose a mandatory content filtering system on the internet, but government censors do enforce takedown notices against ISPs hosting certain kinds of material. The Australian Communications and Media Authority, ACMA, is currently authorized to drop the ban hammer on a wide range of content. All content classified as refuse classification, or X18+, is prohibited online in Australia, including real depictions of actual sexual activity, child pornography, depictions of bestiality, material containing excessive violence or sexual violence, detailed instruction in crime, violence or drug use, and or material that advocates the doing of a terrorist act. R18 plus material comparable to hard R rating in the U.S. can be shown on the internet, but only when it's behind a restricted access system that prevents access by children. Finally, MA15, roughly comparable to PG-13R material in the U.S., content is restricted on mobile devices unless it's behind a similar restricted access system. That's very interesting. They have a different rating system for mobile devices. Interesting. For the last couple of years, the Australian government has been running trials on a new approach to censoring online content. Instead of maintaining a relatively small blacklist of content and serving only takedown notices, the government wants to move to a mandatory and proactive filtering system that every ISP must implement. For some time, there was ambiguity about what material could be included in the filter. The government finally made an official proposal in December 2009, where it made clear that only RC material would be included. This filter would be less restrictive but more proactive than the current regime. It would apply to sites outside of Australia by blocking access, something the ACMA system could not do. Even with the system limited to RC content, however, Google and others have real concerns about what would be blocked. Everyone in the debate appears to agree that blocking depictions of child sex abuse is a legitimate government function. Google notes that such limited internet blocks have been implemented or are being considered in the UK, Canada, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, and New Zealand, and it raises the question of why Australia is ready to go well beyond that scope to the much wider category of RC. All sorts of things can be refused classification in Australia, which makes them illegal to offer for sale. The category includes sexual violence, child pornography, and the like, but it can go far beyond those. Google cites a report by three Australian professors which noted that RC material could include socially and politically controversial material regarding drug use, abortion, and euthanasia. Because Australia's constitution does not contain blanket support for freedom of expression, instead of offering more limited freedom of political discourse. Google argues that there is a significant risk that filtering applies today to RC content could readily be extended by future governments to other forms of expression, whether related to sexual content or violence or not. So, Google is rightly concerned about this, mostly because of the secrecy behind the blacklist. They don't know what's on the blacklist. Nobody knows what's on the blacklist other than the people that are administering the blacklist. So if your website that is speaking out against the government goes on the blacklist, who is to know that people in Australia are not able to see it, if they're not able to see it to begin with? How are they know that it's going to be out there and that kind of information is going to be out there, whether it's legitimate, real information or not? And what right does the government have to step in to censor speech that is unpopular and not dangerous, but unpopular speech because of this secrecy of this blacklist? Whether things get on there on purpose or accidentally, it's hard to say because they are not held accountable. There's no oversight into whether things get on the blacklist or not, or how they get off the blacklist, or what even is even on the blacklist. If you're trying to get to a site and the site is inaccessible, are you going to first turn to the blacklist? Can you even check if it's on the blacklist? You can't check if it's on the blacklist. You're going to have to chalk it up to maybe it's your browser, maybe it's your computer's filter blocking out spammy websites. Maybe it's your ISP has routing configuration problems on its routers. Who knows? And by the time you get to the blacklist, maybe it's too late for that information. Maybe you needed it to make a decision about an upcoming election, an upcoming decision on a law being passed. Maybe it's about an organization against the government, speaking out against the government. They're trying to get a rally going together to protest against the government, and now that's been knocked offline because you can't see it, and the protest is dissolved because they can block technology at a whim. They just say, put this on the blacklist. Later we can apologize for it. You know, once the protest time has been passed, you can take it off the blacklist 2 days later and just throw your hands up in the air and go, I don't know, it wasn't on the blacklist ever. And now they can get through to the site, but it's too late for that kind of information. In worldwide copyright news, full ACTA text leaked. And this was first sent in by Mind Inversion, of course. There's a flurry of people sending this in to me. And I've already also posted a place you can download it off the Pirate Bay where it won't get overwhelmed because it's through torrents. And also somebody has typed it out as text because it was scanned in. And I've also included a link to the text version so you can do a search through it and find what you need. Last April, the U.S. trade representatives explained to us the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement had to stay secret in order to provide room for negotiation. In fact, ACTA was so inchoate that a comprehensive set of proposals for the text of the agreement does not yet exist. In other words, there's nothing to release. That was true in early 2009, but by 2010, there was such a comprehensive set of proposals, and still we got nothing from the ACTA negotiating nations, except a long series of piecemeal leaks that appear to have emanated from Europe. This week, those leaks became a flood, as French digital rights group La Quadrature du Net released a complete copy of ACTA's consolidated text, filled with various textual proposals from different negotiating countries. Much of ACTA isn't particularly controversial, as much of its rhetoric around it has been overblown. Back in 2008, we noted that the hysterical talk of iPod scanning border guards was unhelpful, drawing attention away from the true area of concern: the worldwide imposition of the American Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Stung by those headlines, however, the negotiating governments went out of their way to deny that border guards were going to rifle through luggage looking for illicit music. And indeed, the consolidated text shows that there are no less than 4 explicit proposals that exempt personal, non-commercial luggage from ACTA's proposals. But the DMCA bits of the treaty are also in evidence, demanding widespread adherence to a no circumvention of DRM rule. Countries like New Zealand and Japan are fighting this, along with the insistence that ISPs have some sort of plan to curtail repeat infringements by subscribers. But the US is pushing hard and drafted the relevant sections. Countries like the US could have taken the high ground on transparency, being more upfront about what they wanted from the agreement and pushing hard to release texts like this one. Instead, leaked accounts suggest that the US has been unwilling to push for transparency at ACTA meetings, and the main texts are all leaked anyway. So this leak is actually from January. I haven't done the research to see if there has been a meeting since then, but I know a meeting is coming up in New Zealand for more proposals, so maybe there will be an updated leak for the New Zealand meeting since this has been done, and we can see what the countries have updated if we get another leak of it. But by this time, I would think that a leak would be more readily available since this whole text has been leaked by now. Another story going into more of what the ACTA talks about, ACTA would make service providers the copyright police. After 2 years of excuses for the secrecy of negotiations over ACTA, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, the full draft of the proposal treaty has been leaked online, and it looks just as bad as critics have suggested. Among the worst provisions of the proposal is a requirement that third-party service providers must implement measures to proactively identify and eliminate access to content that is in violation of copyright law. Failure to do so would make them liable for such infringement. Even worse, according to a note from the New Zealand's negotiators, that this would even include search engines. Assuming some service finds a way to implement this sort of proactive system, their ability to safeguard the privacy of users would be severely diminished. Under current laws, when content owners identify content they believe infringe on their copyrights, they can notify service providers such as YouTube and demand that the content be removed. This is known as notice and takedown. Under the ACTA proposal, content owners would also be entitled to any information the service provider has, which could identify the user responsible for the content without any judicial oversight. So no warrant is needed to get the information from the ISP. So if I had a piece of my material up on a website, I could just say, who uploaded this? Please give me their home address so I can enact personal justice upon this person. That's what could happen. You could get this information without a police warrant, without anything. I don't even know how the ISP would identify that you're even the legitimate copyright holder. Right now, it's kind of pass-along information. You don't get the information about the subscriber to the ISP or the person uploaded it, and the information either gets taken down or it doesn't. If you post a 30-second video of your child dancing to a copyrighted song on YouTube and a record label believes it infringes on their copyright, they could demand that YouTube not only take down the video, but also provide them with your private account information unless you come up with the evidence that the takedown request was an error. And service providers aren't only the only parties whose obligations would enforce the other people's intellectual property rights would be drastically increased. Governments would be forced into a new role as well. For starters, it would make customs officials responsible to proactively identify intellectual property infringements in goods crossing national borders. They would, of course, be trained in this role by IP holders rather than some sort of actual legal education. The courts would also be affected by ACTA that would require judges be given the power to issue injunctions for imminent infringement, meaning infringement that hasn't even taken place yet. Additionally, each government that's a party to the treaty would be required to educate the public about the evils of IP infringement. At the end of the day, ACTA isn't about protecting the people who create goods and content. Its real aim is to protect businesses which have traditionally relied on artificial monopoly of intellectual property to make a profit. Rather than the government regulating business, those businesses would be regulating the government. Accusations would be given the weight of judgments, and the presumption of innocence would be replaced by the assumption of guilt. They're bypassing the judicial system with the ACTA. They're going straight from the content owner straight to the person who uploaded it, bypassing the court system and being able to do whatever they want on the internet. This is a lot of trouble for the world, and I'm glad the ACTA agreement finally got leaked so people can have their voice in it around the world with the participating countries. So I hope that the New Zealand Pirate Party is paying attention and can organize something for the next ACTA round of negotiations that is happening in New Zealand and educate the people of New Zealand how this will have an impact on their connection to the internet and people on the internet. What it's going to turn the internet into is a place where people just consume, people where there's no feedback, there's no contribution to the internet. It's a one-way system where content providers are feeding you, such as with television, where people put the content on the television and you sit back and consume. There's no feedback loop. Where this is what made the internet so great. It's what makes it so great right now. And if you're in fear of retribution from content providers, you're not going to be able to contribute back to the net through taking works that are already out there, remixing them, and putting them back as a new public work. And also, you're going to be in fear of putting anything on there. Have you ever seen have you ever seen reality shows nowadays? If you take a look at reality shows nowadays, they've gone down to almost completely blurring out everything in the frame, except for the person that they're focusing on. If they're walking through a house, everything's blurred. If they're walking through public places, everything is blurred around them. Every piece of artwork, every picture of people that is not them, every commercial advertisement in the background, everything is blurred out. It's completely annoying to watch. Whether you like those shows or not, it's a telltale sign of what things are going, how things are progressing. It's complete control by content providers over their product in terms of locking it down and really restricting our culture and what we can do with our culture. Going further, worldwide copyright news. Back ACTA, RIAA, and the MPAA tell Obama. In Britain, Vivendi Universal, EMI, Warner Music, and Sony Music's BPI, British Phonographic Industry, was actually allowed to draft much of the wording for the three strikes element of ACTA, the ACTI counterfeiting trade agreement being touted around the world by shills acting for Hollywood and Big Four record labels. Obviously, this is commentary by the P2Pnet.net. Presented by compliant governments as local legislation, the three strike section would have the administrations acting as copyright agents and ISPs working for the movie and music studios against their mutual customers, who could be disconnected from the net after being accused by the cartels of sharing online. So it's no surprise to learn a group of hardcore vested corporate interest outfits such as the Big Four's RIAA and Hollywood's MPAA want the US President Barack Obama to back ACTA. Interestingly, no one told whoever drafted the missive that Dan the Joker Glickman is no longer the official Hollywood mouthperson. President and CEO Bob Pisano is for now the man at the MPA, but Dan's name is on the letter dated March 22nd. Anyhow, it was with great interest and appreciation that we read your recent remarks concerning the importance of intellectual property. Worthies tell Obama. Going on. You said, our single greatest asset is the innovation, ingenuity, and creativity of the American people. It's essential to our prosperity, but it's only a competitive advantage if companies know that someone else just can't steal the idea and duplicate it with cheaper inputs and labor. This is what Obama said, and I put in the beginning of last week's show. We wholeheartedly concur, indeed, that we could not have stated this essential point any more clearly or succinctly. One way the U.S. can promote effective global intellectual property protection in the digital environments is through the negotiation of a strong and modern intellectual property enforcement agreement, the ACTA. We're very glad to hear you refer to this agreement in your remarks and support the administration's attempt to ensure that discussions advance strong standards and enforcement mechanisms to address the theft of U.S. creativity and ingenuity in this forum, as well as just beginning the negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The organizations listed below, representing musicians, performers, actors, composers, songwriters, music publishers, technicians, craftspeople, directors and their teams, and record and film companies, both large and small, can only underscore, as you indicated, the economic and cultural importance of succeeding in promoting more effective global protection of copyright. America's music and movies are not only central to our nation's economic competitiveness, but they define and reflect our ever-changing cultural landscape and drive technological innovation in the delivery of content. It is essential that U.S. policies ensure that present and future generations of Americans can continue to earn a living through artistic and cultural pursuits that reflect and advance the interests of our diverse nation. Success in enhancing the global protection of intellectual property will directly and significantly expand U.S. exports and create new jobs in an arena where the U.S. enjoys a competitive advantage, an advantage that is now undermined by global theft of intellectual property. We're grateful for your engagement and the support of your administration and your personal leadership on this critical issue. With best regards, we are, and it lists off a whole ton of people, from the RIAA and MPAA and a whole bunch of acronyms going down the list. So that's very telling. Obviously, they'd support the ACTA agreement. And as you heard last week, President Obama is also supporting the ACTA agreement. So it's getting most of its push from the U.S., the corporations, and the political sphere of the U.S. In privacy news from the U.K., airport worker given police warning for misusing body scanner sent in by D.C. The police have issued a warning for harassment against an airport worker after he allegedly took a photo of a female colleague as she went through the full body scanner at Heathrow Airport. The incident, which occurred at Terminal 5 on the 10th of March, is believed to be the first time an airport worker has been formally disciplined for misusing the scanners. A Scotland Yard spokesman said police received an allegation regarding an incident that happened at Heathrow Terminal 5 on March 10th. The first incident harassment warning has been issued to a 25-year-old male. the BAA employee took a photo of his coworker, Jo Margenstern, when she inadvertently went through a scanner. "I can't bear to think about the body scanner thing," she told The Sun. "I'm totally traumatized. I've spoken to the police about it. I'm in too much of a state to go to work." The BAA said, "We treat any allegations of inappropriate behavior or misuse of security equipment very seriously. And these claims are being investigated thoroughly," a BAA spokesman said. "If found to be substantiated, we will take appropriate action. The incident is likely to reignite privacy concerns over the scanners by civil liberty groups. The Equality and Human Rights Commission last month warned that the government needed to take action to bring forth its policy for body scanner passengers at the UK airport within the law. The commission said it had concerns about the apparent absence of safeguards to ensure that scanners were operated in a lawful, fair, and non-discriminatory manner. It raised doubts as to whether the decision to install them at UK airports was legal. The scanners were introduced at Manchester and Heathrow last month after the Christmas Day bombing attempt over Detroit in the US. The 80,000-pound rapid scan machines show a clear body outline and have been determined by critics as the equivalent of a virtual strip searching. While American transport authorities offer passengers a choice between going through the full body scanner and going through the metal arc scanner and a physical search, the British government has said that refusal to go through the body scanner would bar passengers from boarding aircraft. Earlier this month, two women, one a Muslim, became the first people to be barred from boarding a flight at Manchester Airport because they refused to go through a full body scanner. The women who were booked to fly to Islamabad with Pakistan Airlines, International Airlines, were told they could not get on the plane after they refused to be scanned for medical and religious reasons. A House of Commons Home Affairs Committee to report on airport security today welcomed scanner deployment and said it should have come sooner. "Having witnessed these full-body scanners working firsthand, we are confident that the privacy concerns that have been expressed in relation to these devices are overstated and that a full-body scanners are no more an invasion of privacy than the manual pat-downs or searches of bags," the committee said. "Air passengers already tolerate a large invasion of their privacy, and we do not feel that the full-body scanners add greatly to this situation. Privacy concerns should not prevent the deployment of scanners." So, the one thing that they did forget about the privacy of people going through the scanners is the analog hole. I'm not trying to be dirty, but what the music and movie industry always talks about is the analog hole. We've got to plug the analog hole. Is that so people can't take a line out and port it to something else or put a video camera and record a movie? Things like that. Stuff that does not require a digital printout, a digital recording of things. Because they've always said these scanners don't have the ability to print out or store things. Actually, they do, but only in test mode, which they're not currently in. They assure us. But what they can do is display things on screens, which people can see with their eyes. And anything somebody can see with their eyes, they can take a picture of, which allegedly happened in this case. Somebody has a camera. Now the question is, why are airport security able to bring something that has a recording device into their workplace and take a picture of people that are going through scanners? Now, this is an incident where it was of somebody that worked there. But what is preventing that same person or another person taking a picture of a airline passenger? Now, of course, they're going to target people who are well-known, famous people, and take pictures of them, which, you know, is equivalent of virtual strip search, they say. And they could post it on the internet for anyone to see. Why aren't the airline employees getting the same treatment as the airline passengers and being put through a scanner themselves to search for cameras and other recording devices? That's my question. Why are they not being treated with the same courtesy as the airline passengers? Some copyright news from Denmark. Filmmakers fake piracy threat to boost sales sent in by DC. In a desperate cry for media attention, the filmmakers behind the flopped Danish movie Winnie and Karina have accused Pirate Gruppen of stealing their film. In two libelous press releases, they fabricated a piracy threat from the local group of copyright critics, hoping to draw attention to the upcoming DVD release. As a mediocre filmmaker or musician, there is little to fear from piracy. If people don't want to pay for your content, then are not very likely to pirate it either. However, this doesn't mean that it's not possible to benefit from piracy. 2 years ago, we reported on a case where an international leak was used as a promotional tool. When the band Buckcherry found out that their latest single had leaked on BitTorrent, they issued a press release instead of trying to get the torrents offline. In the press release, they reported how devastated they were that the single was up for grabs. However, it all turned out to be a staged event, as we later found out that the person who uploaded the torrent had the same IP address as the band's manager. I'm not sure how they figured that out. Buckcherry's failed PR campaign was pretty low, but Danish filmmakers have taken this particular promotional technique quite a bit further by blaming a third party for the leak. A few days ago, the makers of the film, Winnie and Karina, issued a press release in which they accused the Danish copyright reform group, Pirate Gruppen, of stealing the master DVD. Until now, there's been no ransom demands, but Retner Gratzen Film is willing to do all it can to avoid the film being made available for free online, they wrote in the press release. The film in question was a big flop in theaters, but through the faked piracy threat, they hope that they get some attention for the upcoming DVD release. The press release was ignored by the media, though, so they had to release another one a few days later. In this new press release, they went even further by claiming that Pirate Gruppen was threatening to leak the film on YouTube that evening. I guess in 10-minute chunks? Again, the media didn't pick it up. Eventually, the filmmakers came clean by stating the whole story was made up. Why they did that, I don't know. Why didn't they just shut up about it? I guess it's like bad publicity, still publicity. In an email to Pirate Group and the studio's boss, Regner Gratzen admit that he was desperate because of the bad reviews and disappointing ticket sales. Accusing Pirate Group of breaking into their premises and stealing the master film was just a joke, Gratzen explained in the email. Pirate Gruppen couldn't really see the humor of being accused of a serious crime and call it a pathetic little media stunt. In the end, the filmmakers got a bittersweet result, since although the Danish media finally picked up on their story, their failure was exposed. See, somebody's finally using their head about using the torrents for promotional use. Kind of the wrong way around, though. They're accusing people of stealing and accusing people of crimes that they didn't permit. They think, oh, it's just a torrent site. We can accuse them of, crimes that they could be put in jail for, breaking into people's homes. So it's all fun and games because, you know, they're pirates on the high seas. They're outlaws. No, these are people running a torrent site, not people you can accuse of people breaking into your home. But if your movie is bad, nobody wants to watch it. And if they download it off the internet and turn it off after 10 minutes, they can do the same in the theaters and demand their money back or return the DVD from whence it came and get their money back as well, because if it's a bad movie, it's a bad movie, and no amount of press is going to make it into a good movie. Maybe a bit of re-editing might. Privacy news from the U.S. IRS security faults leave taxpayer information at risk. In this heavy tax season where billions of dollars and tons of personal information is relayed to and from the government, it's more disconcerting to hear that the Internal Revenue Service is still struggling to keep private information secure. A report out today from the watchdogs at the Government Accountability Office says that 69% of the tax agency's previously noted security flaws remain unfixed and continue to jeopardize the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of the IRS's systems. The problems put the IRS at increased risk of unauthorized disclosure, modification, and destruction of financial and taxpayer information, the GAO concluded. FBI details the most difficult internet scams. For example, the GAO stated the IRS continues to use passwords that are not complex, ineffectively remove application accounts in a timely manner for separated employees, allow personnel excessive file and directory permissions, allow the unencrypted transmission of user and administrator login information, install security patches in an untimely manner. More specifically, the GAO said IRS does not always enforce strong identification and authentication. For example, administrator passwords for two servers located at one IRS center were not set to comply with the IRS's password age policy. In both instances, the administrator password age was set to 118 days, which exceeded the IRS's requirement by 58 days. Consequently, an increased risk exists that compromised administrator passwords will be used by unauthorized users for a longer period of time than to gain unauthorized access to the server's resources. So if you can't trust the IRS with your personal information, who can you trust? If they're not following their own guidelines, let alone, you know, recommended guidelines for just general internet security, how can you even trust sending your information that you're required by law to send to them? This is a huge privacy concern, and I'm surprised that they aren't following this, but hopefully, after some pressure from the media and people finding out about this, that they maybe will change their passwords once in a while and bring it up to speed to, you know, the level of where it should be. In copyright news from the UK, web blocking digital economy bill set to become law without full debate. Leader of the House Harriet Harman announced today that the bill would be given its second reading, an intermediate stage in the processes of it becoming law, in which specific details of the legislation are not discussed. On April 6th, the day Gordon Brown is expected to request dissolution of the Parliament in advance of the May 6th election. This would mean that it would not get a third reading, which is when bills are normally fully debated and amendments can be proposed on and voted on. Instead, it would be eligible for the wash-up process, by which legislation whose passage is cut off by an election can be passed into law via negotiations between party whips. The Conservative Party have indicated they will likely cooperate with the passing the law this way. In the Commons, some MPs protested that the rushing through of the legislation. Labour's Neil Gerrard, MP for Wathismato in London, said it's obvious that we're not going to be able to give the normal scrutiny that we would should to the digital economy bill. As somebody who's broadly supportive of that bill, can I say that I'd be concerned at the thought of it being rushed through, some very complex issues being rushed through, on the basis of a deal between the front benches. In response, Mrs. Harman said the ministers responsible for this bill are well aware of the concerns that have been raised. The digital economy bill's most controversial elements could see people's internet connections cut off if they're accused of copyright infringement, such as file sharing and websites accused of promoting copyright infringement blocked. It has been warned that it could also spell the end of free Wi-Fi services and internet cafes as providers of internet connections and would be held legally responsible for the actions of anybody using their connection. The bill has been criticized by major internet companies such as Google, Facebook, eBay, by internet service providers including BT, Virgin Media, and TalkTalk, by digital rights campaign groups, and by Labour MP Tom Watson. Yesterday, a protest estimated at several hundred people gathered outside the Parliament to protest against the legislation. The Open Rights Group says that over 17,000 people wrote to the MPs demanding a full debate, and almost 35,000 people have signed a petition calling on the bill's disconnection provisions to be dropped. Open Rights Group Executive Director Jim Killock said, "This bill will restrict individual rights and freedoms and punish innocent people by disconnecting them. This needs democratic debate, and it could not simply be pushed through during wash-up." So I'm not sure how far it's going to get because of the time limitations that have been imposed by the election. But hopefully there'll be more debate and more concern raised by people of the Parliament about the clauses of people getting disconnected by the digital economy bill. That's the hinge on which the protests rest, and the people, why the people are protesting against it, being disconnected from the data stream that is the internet. People use it on a daily basis, and it can't just be cut off for people by accusations by corporate interests without any due process. Even with due process, being cut off from the internet is not something that people can face in this day and age. They need it for their jobs. Unless it's like a manual labor job, you're going to need the internet, even to communicate with your boss or to get information about health information from the government. Some things are being posted online rather than going in and getting them. It's it's something that people use on a daily basis, and it really can't be pushed aside by accusations from corporate interests. Copyright news from the U.S. L.A. band tries to cash in with free monthly album. Now, this is a good spin on how bands can use the internet for good instead of just trying to sue their fans off the internet and get them disconnected. In an instrument-filled garage, almost every day for the past year, musician John Wood has tried to find a new way to make a living. Wood and a bunch of other artists use the soundproof space with an extra high ceiling to create a new album every month. It's a staggering feat when you consider it means recording a new song every 3 days, and they essentially give it away for free. Wood is at the vanguard of how musicians are negotiating pay in a world overrun with free music online. He distributes his music to anyone who wants to download it, copy it, or share it with other people. He then asks for donations or subscriptions to CDs he sends in the mail. Many artists have tinkered with the mostly or completely free online album releases, such as Radiohead and Trent Reznor's Nine Inch Nails. They've instead aimed to make money on sales of souped-up deluxe CD sets or concert tickets. But musicians like Wood, who don't have a huge fan base, are unlikely to make it by filling arenas or selling high-priced goods. As regular CD sales continue to fall and major record labels pair their artist rosters, up-and-coming musicians have to find ways to promote themselves in ways that are unheard of a few years ago. Wood's album a month plan, along with a written blog explaining his inspirations, is designed to spur interest and build loyalty among his fans. He hopes that one day some real money can be made from it as well. Obviously, that would be a great side of it, and that's something we're aiming towards, Wood says, sitting by a mixing board surrounded by guitars and keyboards on a Friday afternoon. To me, this whole project is really about music, art, and creativity. So what this musician is doing is going back really to the roots of music and performing for money, rather than, say, recording an album and resting upon that album's laurels for the next, 70, 90 years by enforcing the copyright on the album and its perpetuity of being able to rake in money forever. And he's conforming to the new laws of music making, because you can't fight what is happening now. People are going to get your music for free, so you have to be creative and innovative, like this guy is doing, by really giving music to the people. And it goes on, and he says he's even making individualized songs for people, like recording birthday songs for people, and that's giving a real service from an artist to the fans. And I think that's a great way to give back to the fans, and it's very interesting. And that's going to round off all the news stories with something a little positive this week. And it's kind of nice seeing that people are thinking of new ways to innovate the music scene and give back to the fans rather than suing them. Now, I do have some things that you can watch and listen to, some great stuff. One is from Larry Lessig, and another one is from Rick Falkfinch, the head of the Pirate Party of Sweden. First one is Larry Lessig on laws that choke creativity. And it's a TED Talk, which are always good. TED Talks are great. This was sent in by Dark Light, so I've linked that in the forum, so take a listen to that. And also a Google Talk by Rick Falvinch on copyright regime versus civil liberties. Now, this Google Talk is a number of years old, I think 3 or 4 years old, but it still rings true today, and it's a great primer for why copyright needs reform and why patents need reform, and a good introduction to also the Pirate Party as well. I highly recommend it. I think they're both about an hour long, and something to pass the time this week, so take a look at those. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more of what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. And if you have news stories you'd like to hear in the show, questions or comments, just head over to thepiratepartyradio.com, submit them through the forum on the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.